What?
We're live.
We're live? Hi, ZFAC Super PAC. We're starting this show. We're doing something different. We are going live to the Super PAC supporters who pay $4.99 a month to be a part of this movement and have first dibs at our next guest. You're going to want to rip this guy a new one, okay, when you hear his story. Dr. Todd Strumwasser, okay, he is the Senior Vice President of Operations for like the San Francisco Bay Area Dignity Health Hospitals. He is a physician, but also a leader and an administrator, and we are here to ask him the tough questions. He's gonna talk to us about clinical leadership and why we need it, and all the sort of ins and outs about how we're gonna transform healthcare with our partners in clinical leadership instead of an us and them scenario, unless we hate him, in which case it will be us and them. Todd, what up, fam?
Thank you so much for having me here. This is like a dream come true for me.
Did you hear that, guys? An administrator just said it's a dream come true to be on our show. We have broken some kind of sound barrier, I think. Something tremendous.
You have. I have.
No. The fact that you actually came out from the Bay to be here is a big honor for us, actually. And the reason we got connected is you reached out, you'd seen the show, and we had a call. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to hate this guy. He's an administrator. I know because I was an administrator at Turntable, and I hated myself. And then I love you. I love what you're doing. I love the fact that you're trying to lead with clinical experience. And we talked about the hard path of trying to do that. One thing I want to say is this show, after we get comments from our Super PAC and questions for you, we're going to then put it live to the full squad maybe later in the week, because I want to give the Super PAC, who they are our super fans, man. These are the people who really want to transform healthcare to the point where they're spending $4.99 a month to be a part of this. We want them to weigh in and go, okay, these are the key things we want to hit that'll then inform the main page. So it really empowers them to have a voice.
Right.
So let me ask you a question, man. You were a UC Davis undergrad.
Right.
I used to teach MCAT at UC Davis.
Wow.
Yeah, the AGs, man.
I should have taken that.
Yeah, you should have taken it. Yeah, then you would have passed.
I messed those up bad.
Did you?
Yeah.
I actually didn't do great on the MCAT. Like, my best score was general chemistry, which I knew the least about. And then they made me teach general chemistry at the MCAT course. And I'm like, P equals NRT. I don't, what? It was crazy.
Yeah.
But then you finished that and you went to, where was it?
USC Medical School.
USC.
Yeah.
And then after that, you did residency in Seattle.
At Seattle, University of Washington, and anesthesiology for 3 years. Now it's a 4-year program.
Oh, so you grandfathered in.
Grandfathered in, and then I practiced in Seattle for 25 years.
Wow,
yeah,
how are you not just so depressed all the time?
I'm not depressed because I'm no longer doing it. But, part of it's Seattle, but, you know, living there in the gray, and that can be hard. And part of it is anything we do, you know, that we get stuck into, you know, there's burnout, right?
Mm.
And there's a lot of burnout in anesthesia. There's a lot of burnout in a lot of fields.
But what was Washington worse? Because I tell you, I'm deeply affected by weather. And even at UCSF, it would be foggy all the time.
Right.
It was just miserable for me.
Yeah, so my wife, who's an artist and needs light, this was like terrible for her. She had to get out of there. Because there's like, you know, 2 months a year that you get reliable sunshine. The rest of the time, it's a gray hanging over there. And it's not raining a lot, but it's gray.
Yeah.
So it really works on people. Not everyone, but some people get that seasonal affective disorder there.
Yep, for real.
Yeah.
But you somehow transitioned from full-time anesthesia to CEO, ultimately, of Swedish.
Well, I was the chief executive of the two downtown Swedish campuses.
Got it.
The way this came about was, so we had my anesthesia group, there were 60 of us at the time, now there's over 100. And I was the managing partner, and which was really a hellish work. Because basically you're telling all your colleagues what to do all the time, and they hate you.
Yeah, so because the doctors hate being managed.
They hate being managed.
Right, and so does everybody else.
And actually. But if you're one of them and you're managing them, they tolerate it knowing that you're going to come back and then they're going to beat the hell out of you.
Right.
Yeah,
right. They're
going
to yell at you.
So what I did was I sort of saw that coming back in part, and I'm like, oh, I'm not going to come back in.
Yeah.
And I became chief of staff at Swedish, which was really a cool thing to do. Because as an anesthesiologist, you're stuck in the OR all day long. You don't know what's happening on the wards. I learned about hospital medicine, length of stay, productivity, you know, hospital-acquired conditions, all these things you don't know about in the OR as chief of staff. And then I went to business school at University of Washington.
Oh, so you went back, got an MBA.
Yeah, I worked at Keio, went to school at night, didn't get the full MBA, just did a one-year program. And they hired me back to be the vice president of medical affairs. And then Swedish got acquired by Providence, and I became the chief operating officer at the downtown two Seattle campuses. And then I became the chief executive. And then I got this call to come down to the Bay Area. I'm like, I'll be there.
Yeah, because you're done. You're done with the gray.
Yeah, done with the gray. And so I've been in the Bay Area for 4 years now, over four hospitals in the San Francisco Bay Area, St. Mary's, St. Francis, Sequoia, and Dominican.
Great hospitals.
Down to Santa Cruz and up to San Francisco.
So that full Northern Bay.
Yeah.
But, you know, so here's a question. Why? Why did you leave clinical medicine? Because there's a shame factor.
There is a shame factor.
And there's a jealousy factor, both.
Both. And that's the interesting thing. That's the dynamic that we encounter, is that I hate you, but can you tell me how you did this? And I can do it, too. But, you know, the other thing, too, that I'll, you know, that I'll say is, you know, it's nice using a different part of your brain. And what I, you know, and so anyway, that was very good. And happy to do that.
You mean the MBA part of it and the leadership part of it?
Yeah, just looking at things differently and being a leader and trying to affect change on a broader level.
Was the MBA necessary, or was it?
You know, the business school experience helps so that you learn the language. So I can, I know what things like ROI is and EBITDA and P&L and a lot more acronyms that I'd have to teach you, but I don't have the time.
Sorry, earnings before interest and depreciation and something else, EBITDA.
Whoa.
That's right.
80%, you nailed it.
80%.
4 out of 5. Amortization.
Amortization, that's a good one. Yeah.
You pass.
Yeah.
So anyways.
You learn the language.
You learn the language, so you can talk to the CFOs, and they can't bamboozle you, but you can still bamboozle them because they don't know medicine.
They don't know medicine.
That's the cool part.
So that's a secret.
That's a secret.
So would you say, and I think, you know, having gone this route, we'll dig more into it, but part of the reason I wanted you on the show is because I want to inspire other clinicians to not be afraid to say, okay, you know what, I can be a leader, not a manager, I can be a leader in an organization because I can speak some business-ish, but I know patients, I know my colleagues, I know how we work, and I know what we need to do.
Right.
So I can help lead us to this better vision of how things can be done. How hard, how scary was it for you to go that route, or was it more scary not to go that route and stay in clinical medicine the way things are going?
So, well, that's the other thing, too. As an anesthesiologist, which I was a proceduralist, basically, you know, I put in art lines and CVPs and swans and, you know, did epidural blocks and things. So, you know, using your psychomotor skills a lot. When I dropped down to one day a week, I felt a little scary. I felt like I wasn't quite safe.
You weren't up to speed.
I wasn't up to speed. So, you know, that's the thing. And if you're in a cognitive field, like a rheumatologist, you can probably, you know, work one day a year and still be safe.
Yeah.
As an anesthesiologist, I started having to rethink everything I was doing, and I was like, I need to fish or cut bait.
So the muscle memory started to fade.
Muscle memory, and also just all the routines that you get into that you don't even think about, they're unconscious about how I'm going to take care of you on the operating table, and I'm going to keep you, you know, euthermic, normotensive, and make sure all the, keep your oxygen levels up, and how am I going to do all that stuff,
you know,
reliably. And,
so it makes sense. So you had to ultimately say, it's been about 7 years or so since you've physically been in the OR doing that work.
Right.
Right. And you know what? There's a lot of there are a lot of doctors, and this happened at my old organization as a Sutter Health Palo Alto Medical Foundation. And you know, our clinical leaders would still practice 30% time, 40% time, and the other doctors would give them shit.
Right.
They would say, you know, do you even see patients? It's like, dude, a third of my time. And when they go to close to zero, people just get outraged. But the truth is, what they don't realize is, and I think they do realize it, they're not able to accept it, is that to do what you do, okay, you have all this area under the curve of clinical experience. You've made this impact. You've also conditioned yourself to understand that side. Now, to really make a difference, you have to focus on this leadership role. I mean, is that wrong? Am I getting it wrong that way?
No, I mean, no, I think you're right. You focus on the leadership role. The thing about it is you have credibility because you've been a physician, you've taken care of patients. Mm. I still make rounds in the hospitals, you know, with my chief medical officers, you know, I know what questions to ask. I know what should be happening. I know what the expectations are. Mm. You know, so being able to talk business to the physicians and medicine to the administrators puts you in kind of a rarefied air. It's like the Rosetta Stone. It really, there are, as I was telling you earlier, there's very few physician administrators.
That's crazy to me.
It's really crazy.
Because a lot of them are entrepreneurial, a lot of them have a business mind, but what ends up happening is they end up going into these, like, they'll open up, you know, outpatient knee, you know, ortho practice and churn volume and make a lot of money that way and then invest in properties and do stuff like that. How about doing something where you're actually giving back to the profession that gave so much to you by improving it? Yeah.
So the question I always ask is, what's the problem you're trying to solve? You know, so when you have doctors that are doing concierge medicine, and I know there's other names for it, it's like, are you really, so your goal, your mission statement is I'm going to improve healthcare access for rich people? It's just not real compelling to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, so what's the problem you're trying to solve? Well, the problem that I'm trying to solve is we're trying to improve the quality and access and cost of healthcare for everyone.
Right. Well, and I would say, you know, and I'll say there's concierge and then there's direct primary
right.
care at the lower end of that. And they're really looking at middle class and even poorer people who have no care and they're able to provide for a membership fee. But I think you're right. The problem to be solved, and that's a business way of thinking. What is the problem to be solved? Now, so here's, let me segue that into the way we measure success now in hospitals. So let's use something that's very polarizing because I know a lot of our fans are going to hate even this acronym, and that's HCAHPS. So now you're the evil hospital administrator. Partially your hospital is getting rated on HCAHP scores. What are they? Why are they? Are they useful? What are your thoughts on it?
So the federal government years ago decided that they were going to withhold some of the money that they give us being hospitals, based upon how well patients experience the care they're getting. Mm-hmm. So that wouldn't be one of the many metrics that they're going to not pay you more for, but pay you less if you screw up.
So in other words, you would normally get X.
Yeah.
Now they're saying, no, we're going to give you less than that, but if you do okay on these metrics, we'll give you more.
Exactly. Exactly. But, you know, this is one of the things I actually agree with. So I think that the way patients experience
Tad is very angry at you, Todd. Tad is very angry at you.
The way patients experience us is very important. All of us have been on the other side of it. We've been consumers of healthcare. And some of us have had pretty crappy experiences, right? And yeah, and so you're saying, well, why does it have to be this way? You know, why does a nurse have to like throw the bedpan at me? Why does, you know, someone have to be snarky with me? You know, I mean, because you're there on the scariest day of your life and you're the most vulnerable and you're the most worried. So, you know, all human kindness can go a long way.
Oh, I see you threw in the Dignity Health slogan there. Nice. Look at you. You know what? This interview is over. well, okay, so you and I agree 100% on this, that the patient experience is a crucial factor. And I'm a believer that we're all just these conscious agents interacting with each other, and experience is the currency of the realm. So in other words, all we are is experiences, and we're experiencing each other right now. Todd is
right.
experiencing the icon of me, and we're communicating. So this is crucial, but I think part of the problem is with all the commodification of the staff, how is it possible for us to provide this experience when we're feeling like cogs in a very broken machine? We're suffering moral injury from it.
Right, and that's why we need more physicians and clinicians running hospitals, because right now you've got somebody telling you, okay, you're a hospitalist, you're gonna have 18 patients tonight. Why? Because that's what we need to have you do. That's gonna be your benchmark, your expectation.
Yeah.
Well, what if my patients are really sick? Do I still want 18 or maybe do I want 10? So we want people to understand medicine and, you know, what's the expectation of you as a clinician? Because obviously if I give you 100 sick patients to manage, your HCAHP scores are going to suck, right?
Yeah.
And that's what some of them tell me, is that, you know, we're being overloaded right now.
Right.
So how can you expect us to do this?
Now some of that is because in this country we have fewer doctors per capita than, say, in Europe, et cetera, because I think physicians have kind of pushed back to keep the number of slots low, keep the salaries high, so they get paid pretty decently, but they have to work really, really hard. Is the answer having more slots for residency?
I think that's part of it. I think also using allied health professionals, I'll use that term.
Yeah, tell me about this. Don't say mid-level because it triggers everybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, nurse practitioners, PAs,
absolutely.
APRNs.
Medical assistants, you know.
But why is that not an attack on my sovereignty and autonomy as a doctor?
Because you're still going to be the doc making the medical judgment. But in order for you to be supported as this brain sitting on a pedestal, you want to have a lot of people around you that are taking vital signs, that are, you know, collating the labs for you and bringing them to you, and scribes, so that you can actually do the stuff. You know, you've heard the term operate at the top of your license.
Right.
So you can do all the stuff you're trained to do when you were a medical student and a resident.
So let's say how does a PA fit into the pantheon of this in your operational experience?
I think PAs can do quite a bit of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, PAs, you know, there's, you know, when you go into the ER these days, chances are very good, unless you've got a ruptured AAA, you're gonna have a PA looking after you, because that's how ERs have become more efficient. It's depending upon the acuity of the illness you come in with, a PA can see you, and then they should be able to triage you, you know, triage you to a higher level of care, or be able to report on you to the MD, so the MD can come in and, you know, it takes a village is how I would put it.
So in other words, yeah, the bottom line is it's a team.
It's a team.
So I think where people get very triggered is nurse practitioners, PAs are going to replace doctors, or they're going to practice independently in a rural area and replace doctors. And honestly, and this is my stance on that, I think everyone should practice at the top of their license, but we have to be very careful what that license is. So if your scope of practice is X, then practice at the top of that in a team. But I'm really, I get nervous when, because we know the kind of levels of clinical judgment that it does take. It takes a lot of training, and some nurse practitioners have it because from pure experience, and some don't. Some doctors don't have it. So in some way, you know, the guest we had on the other day was talking about this. How do we even test whether our clinicians are practicing without this variation in care in a consistent way?
Well, you know, this is a little bit of the hope of the EHR now. The dreaded EHR has not lived up to its expectations.
To say the least.
To say the least. Yeah. Billions upon billions of dollars have been spent, and we don't really have a lot to show for it. Mm. One of the things we were hoping for is with computer order physician entry, we could have algorithmic things happening. So patient comes in with leukocytosis and, you know, tachypnea and tachycardia, you could do the sepsis protocol, right? And you could use the sepsis order set.
Right.
And that would somewhat force you to do things in an evidence-based way. But we still have physicians opting out. And you know, we lose patients on that, based on that. You know, I mean, we had an example I came across recently where a patient came in with those very three things, you know, high white count, tachycardic, febrile, and they should have started a sepsis protocol, but because the guy was eating a turkey sandwich, wait a minute, he's eating a turkey sandwich, he's got to be okay. Positive turkey sandwich sign. You remember that one?
Right, I do.
Yeah, but you know,
it also means they just got dilaudid. Exactly.
Yeah. So then they dismissed all the objective data and they went to more of a subjective clinical judgment, sent the patient home, they came back and flared sepsis.
This is the thing. So I actually, and I think some of my fans will be surprised to hear this from me, I was actually a big fan of our order sets in Epic. And I'll tell you why. As a hospitalist, it's very much, you know, I know in anesthesia, I know in surgery, it is like flying a plane. There are checklists, you do need to make sure you don't miss anything. Why is that any different in hospital medicine? ER docs will tell you this. They'll say, if you're comparing us to a pilot, it's like we're flying 30 planes at a time and they're all trying to crash. All we're trying to do is keep them in the air. We can't get involved in the subtlety. And I think there's some truth and some falsity to some simplification of that. But for a hospital doc like myself, having an order set meant this to me. Oh, I didn't forget the DVT prophylaxis.
Exactly.
I didn't forget, you know what? This is interesting. Could this guy have sepsis? Why count's a little elevated, a little tachypnic. I wasn't suspecting it, but now I'm wondering, let me just do this, and it'll save your ass.
Yeah.
And because we're human beings, and we can't hold all this in our head, especially when we have 18 patients.
Right. And that's the whole human error thing. You know, there's always going to be human error. So how do we keep our patients safe? How do we not have medical errors? What do we lose? Was it 300,000 lives a year, some big number like that? It's because we're human, and no one's our wingman. We need a wingman.
Right.
You know, so, you know, someone to say, hey, Todd, have you thought about, you know, diabetic ketoacidosis here? Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that?
And the key thing is not having ego push back.
So
we were talking to Bill Rifkin the other day. I think you saw that show. And the whole, you know, we didn't even get into some of the deeper stuff. I mean, we are causing harm on an epic scale, largely due to physician and clinician ego saying, no, you don't tell me how to do things. But no, we're just trying to say, if you do this one protocol, you can have the autonomy to tweak it. Right. You know, we're not saying you have to do it. It's just this will help save your patients' lives and eliminate this unexplained variation in care where one doc does it this way, one doc does it this, but if you look at their outcomes, they are different outcomes.
Right.
It's not, and as we said, there's a lot in medicine where we just don't know. So do it however you like because we just don't know, but there's a lot where we do.
So you just nailed it and you brought up another really big important subject, which is patient safety. Mm. And why can't we in healthcare be as safe as the airline industry?
We should be safer.
We should be safer. Yeah. The nuclear power industry. And all of these industries went through this transformation where they said, what will it take to be zero error? And what they came up with was something what you just described, which is power distance.
Mm.
So yes, I'm the doctor, but if the nurse says to me, you know, Dr. Stromwasser, why are you wearing your mask right now? You're in the operating room. I'm like, oh shit, I'm putting my mask on.
Yeah.
But if I'm an asshole, I'm gonna start yelling at that nurse, say, how dare you? I'm a doctor. You didn't know that Thursdays are no mask days, whatever I come up with. You know, so you have to decrease the power distance to empower everyone to be able to speak up and say, you know, Dr. Demania, it feels like you should be washing your hands before you go into that patient's room.
I'll be like, you shut your hole.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm the doctor, and then I'm washing my hands.
So now in the airline industry, the co-pilot can say to the pilot, you know what, I'm not sure we went through this checklist. Could we do this? And he can't say, you're fired. You can't say that anymore.
Can't say it anymore. No. Well, Malcolm, this is actually a very important topic of discussion because we have a lot of nurses in the audience. And the thing is, they feel scared to speak up. Now they're protocoled so much that the critical thinking has been less important in their training because now they're like, well, you make sure these click these boxes in Epic or whatever. But the thing is, Malcolm Gladwell wrote the book, I don't know if it was Outliers or Equivalent. They're all the same. It's like, here's stuff that's obvious. Let me write a book about it. But the obvious stuff that he said
happen to you someday. So
exactly, I know. I'll write a book. I'll be like, hey, guys, Health 3.0. What the heck?
My kids are going to college right now. Here's another book.
Yeah, here's another book, right? I need the money in advance. What he said was, it was Korean Airlines. And that was the example they gave. And Korean Airlines, for a period of time, had the worst safety record in the industry. And when the evil HCAPS people in airlines, the regulators, looked at it, what they found was, in Korean culture, and even within the language, is embedded a power distance and a hierarchy. So there's even honorifics that you use based on your hierarchical status, seniority, et cetera. So in the cockpit in a Korean Airlines, and think about the OR. It's the same thing. Think about the floor with the nurses calling the docs afraid to say something, right? Or tell you that you didn't wash your hands in mask. They couldn't address the captain, the co-pilot, couldn't address the captain, even though the captain was heading towards a cliff. They crashed into the cliff instead of violating the social order. And then they changed it. They said, okay, no. Now we're going to change how we do this protocol. And their safety record went to like one of the top in the business.
Absolutely.
Overnight.
That's key. And all four of my hospitals right now are doing this culture of safety training, what it's called, keep me safe training. And it's all about that.
Yeah, but how do you, so, I mean, let me see if there's some comments that address this. But see, like, you know, like Jen Walters, not a hospital nurse, so order sets sound like SOPs, standard operating procedures. Is that a realistic comparison? Used to be a lab rat for microbiology on my campus. So are they like standard operating procedures? Is there such a thing when you have a human being at the other end that has a million different potential etiologies and stuff going on?
So when you and I were in training, you know, if we had told our attending, you know, I had a patient with, you know, these were his lab values, and he'd say, well, don't tell me, we're not gonna treat lab values, we're gonna treat the patient. So what do you think? Yeah. So they were giving us license to use clinical judgment.
Autonomy license.
And now things have shifted. And now we're saying, okay, you know, you can have a little bit of autonomy. But for the most part, if you've got X, Y, and Z, you need to do A or B. Mm. So we're not becoming robots, but we're taking away the art of medicine, because it used to be called the art of medicine, right?
Yeah. Well, I think there should be a balance between art, business, and science of medicine. And like Courtney Davis says, I watched a physician use the wrong size IO needle on an obese patient. It was then I knew if I was dying, I would never want them working on me, Courtney Davis. Now, let me push back on this. So you see this, it ought to be that you go, you know, I was curious, that seems like it's a little big or a little small. Wouldn't you use this one? Wouldn't you want to use that no matter where you are in the hierarchy as a teachable moment for that clinician instead of saying, oh, that's a person I'm never going to deal with again?
Well, that's exactly right. You have to, but it's also the how you do this.
How you do it.
You don't yell in front of the patient and say, God damn it, what are you doing?
And we see that all the time.
So it's like, you know, excuse me, doctor, could I speak with you for a moment?
Yeah.
And have a rapport and a respect for one another.
Right. And I'm not, Courtney, I'm not criticizing you. I'm saying this is common because we're afraid we're going to be retributed against. Some doctors will just bite your head off if you dare to question them.
Right.
And but you know, the best doctors I've worked with, they're not like that. They want, you know, and I'm not going to put myself in the pantheon of best doctors, but I relied on the rest of the staff to help me.
Oh.
I mean, I wanted them to save my ass because I would screw it up.
When I first started practice, and I thought I was the smartest anesthesiologist on the planet, right? I was board certified, newly trained. I was so smart. And I had a recovery room nurse pull me aside and said, Dr. Stromos, I want to tell you something. All of your patients in the recovery room are barfing. I'm like, all of them? Well, most of them. I'm like, oh my God, that's terrible. What should I do? And she said, well, go talk to Dr. Eng, find out what he does. So I went and talked to Dr. Eng, and Dr. Eng had a cocktail he used, and I adopted it, and guess what? My patient stopped barfing. So if she hadn't had the audacity to approach me, and I hadn't had the humility to listen to what she was saying, all my patients would have barfed for the next 25 years.
Yeah, and you never would have changed, because one of the things that Dr. Rifkin brought up is that we have no capacity as clinicians yet to know what our neighbors are doing.
Right.
What are other people? You go to a conference and people are like, well, there's some guy on the stage, it's always a guy, and he's like, well, the thing that I do for my gout is I make sure to insert the needle just below the thing and then I send it off right away. That's all you know. You don't know what the best practices are that your neighbors are doing, and I think that's a problem. So when you learned that, it was a nurse who was the conduit of that.
Right.
Tell me more about nurses. You're the operations guy.
Yeah.
They're crucial to everything in the hospital. Yet there are some challenges, right? What do you think is going on?
There's lots of challenges. So the pay rate. So right now, if I look at, for every dollar that the hospital brings in, 60 to 70 cents of that dollar goes to labor costs.
Right.
And so it's mostly nurses and, you know, others that work in the hospital.
What about doctors? Where are they on that?
Well, the doctors don't fit into that. Well, in the state of California,
right.
So there's a foundation that's a separate entity.
Yeah.
So, but you're right. Technically, the doctors, and yes, the doctors are a lot of that as well.
Right. But not technically paid by the hospital necessarily.
Yeah, not in the state of California.
Right, you're right. Because there's a corporate practice of medicine
laws. Corporate practice of medicine.
Right.
But you're right. We've overpaid doctors. And we've paid doctors to do the wrong things, too. So when you pay.
That's really what it is. Not overpaying, it's paying them to do the wrong things.
Yeah. So there was a famous case, and I'm sure those of you that are listening may have watched this in Seattle Times a couple years ago, where a neurosurgeon racked up an enormous number of RVUs. Everybody got craniotomies. And he himself was paid on an RVU basis. So guess what? He did very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out there was a lot of scrutiny on this, because should all of those patients gotten craniotomies?
Mm.
So this is the thing that I think we all need to talk about as a mature adults is, guess what? The very things we pay for is what we get.
Yeah.
So if you pay doctors for RVUs, you're going to get RVUs.
Yeah, to me, this is insane. And this is the fundamental premise of what we're trying to do in terms of transforming healthcare, which is we should be paid to actually do the right thing for patients, not necessarily to do things to patients.
Right.
Now, there are some specialties where it's very tough to go to a capitated or a fee for outcome or a bundled. But I think for most, it's where we have to go. And then we have to start training our medical students to understand that just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And we need to really have true shared decision making with our patients. And the power distance is, and again, I like that term. I haven't heard it in a while. It's a good term. It's like, this is why you got your MBA, so that you could throw around shit like power distance.
I got a ton of them.
You got, give me some more, throw some more terms at me.
Later.
Okay, good. Yeah. I like technical deep dive, field level traction. We're really getting some field level traction out there. Do you ever feel you're walking through the hospital and the doctors and stuff look at you like you're this asshole traitor?
They hate me.
Do they really?
Well, some of them do. I mean, as I say, it's a mixture between jealousy and hatred and just kind of like, what happened to you? And, you know, so it's...
And that's really encouraging more to go into leadership, isn't it, when we behave like that?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Because the moment you work for administration, you've gone to the dark side.
Right. Well, you know, I want to go back to the nursing thing, because you said something. So labor costs are 60%.
Labor costs are high. Nurses are, I think, very reasonably paid nowadays.
At least in the Bay Area.
At least in the Bay Area.
Right.
And nurses are doing the bulk of the frontline work, right? And we need nurses. We love nurses. But in California, they also have legislated nursing ratios.
Which is happening in, it's up for vote in Massachusetts. Now, you're the evil administrator. Tell me what you think about this.
I don't think it's a good idea, because, you know, when you legislate things, like I remember when this, I don't know if you remember this, so the city of Berkeley prohibited ECTs. I'm like, seriously, as a county or as a city, you can forbid
electroconvulsive therapy.
Yeah, you can say no more laparoscopic cholecystectomies, no more. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. So I don't know if that's still on the books, but I think when the government gets involved at that level, they don't really understand. So sometimes nursing ratios need to be 4-to-1, sometimes 3-to-1, sometimes 5-to-1, based on acuity, based on a number of things. It's not something we want Donald Trump to weigh in on.
Right.
Or the Senate or Congress. It's just wrong. It's wrong-minded.
So let me push back and say, well, you know, Upton Sinclair in The Jungle describes this horrible working environment where children are laboring in our food industry and people are dying from food poisoning, et cetera. Don't we need some regulation to prevent hospitals? Because you said 60% of the cost is labor. Well, you're going to want to squeeze that cost by changing staffing ratios, potentially in an unsafe way. Isn't that true or no?
I don't want to do that. So the way I approach all this stuff is I want to give the best care possible. I'm not running for office. I want to give the best care possible, like have the best patient experience and the best quality outcomes. And then I think the business end will take care of itself. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to be the business guy who's going to say, let's just make a lot of money and to hell with everything else. That's why we need more clinicians doing healthcare administration, because we took the Hippocratic Oath, right? Mm-hmm. We know what the right thing to do is. We're, you know, not saying we're all going to do the right thing, but we know what the right thing is.
So how do you think you guys would manage nurse staffing in the absence of the California legislation?
Well, the same way we did it in Seattle. So we staffed according to need. We staffed according to how many patients were with this level of acuity were in this ward.
And, so acuity-based.
Yeah, acuity-based.
Right. And location-based.
Demand-based. Right. And we were able to do it properly. And the nursing unions in the state of Washington were pushing for legislated ratios, but it never got there.
Got it. Have you heard about the Massachusetts legislation?
No, I haven't.
Okay, I get a lot of questions about it from nurses on both sides. So it's interesting because there are nurses practicing. Some feel that it should be legislated, and others feel like, no, it's another regulation that's then going to force the hospital to cut corners elsewhere to pay for mandated staffing.
Right.
So I haven't weighed in directly because I don't know enough about this issue, and I wanted an expert on the show. But I think that, and again, getting into the politics of it is not something I typically do. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because this is on people's minds. It's that tension between, can I do my job? Do I have the resources? Do I have the tools? Do I have the autonomy? Are my leaders leading or are they managing me? And you know, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, I think as long as we all agree as to why we're coming to work, what our mission statement is, you know, I'm not doing a commercial for Dignity Health, but we do care for the poor and vulnerable. And that's our mission statement. You know, everyone comes in regardless of your ability to pay. And we try to make that work somehow. So, you know, I think that when everyone who's working there understands what the mission is and understands why we're there, I think we're all more likely to do the right thing, particularly when we're good people about it. We're not, you know, I'm not coming in there with a whip saying, you know, the morale will improve or the beatings will continue. I'm not saying that.
Yeah. And there's a lot of opinions in the comments about staffing ratios, things like that. Georgette says, love my order set, saves my ass when I have to work with an intensivist who used to be the quote unquote boss and now is age old yet can't let the reins go. So this actually, I think to some extent, you know, there's a saying, right? Medicine changes one funeral at a time. And I think it's true because we condition our docs, they get older, they don't change their ways. Then you show up with an EHR, you show up with order sets, and they're like, blah, blah, blah. But by sort of, to some extent, compelling it, it actually does shift behavior. Context does discern behavior. We had Robbie Pearl, Kaiser CEO, on the show. I love it because I think like every competitor in the Bay Area has somehow been on the show. And he was saying the same thing. It's like, what we set our incentives. Yeah. Is it our view? Is it salary? What is the context? And this idea of the neurosurgeon doing all the craniotomies, the same thing happened to cardiac bypass CABG in Northern Cali. They were looking in Reading and there was a group of they're just doing CABG on everyone.
Right.
And they were not bad human beings. What was happening is they're seeing these incentives, they're conditioned to do stuff to people. They do stuff, they think they're doing good. If you actually look at the data, they're doing harm and they're costing money.
Right.
But they don't know it at all because they're blind to it.
It's also a matter of like, you know, if you have a hammer, the whole world's a nail.
Of course.
You know, so if you're a cardiac surgeon, you want to solve everything with, you know, a sternotomy.
Right.
And, you know, it's like your favorite show, New Amsterdam, and how you fired them all. That was a great scene, though.
you fired. And yes, I am serious. All right.
And they just also got up and walked out.
Also, there's an acute diabetic with chest pain in the ear right now who probably needs a CABG. Which one of y'all is going to do it that I just fired?
I know. You have to admit, it was very interesting.
It was interesting. I like that they're actually just raising these crazy issues.
Well, what's really interesting is that when I was growing up, I was watching Ben Casey and Dr. Kildare.
Yeah.
And these doctors were just deified.
Deified, yeah.
And now it's a way more of a, I don't say realistic, but, you know, slightly more cynical approach to it.
Yeah. No, very much so. Now I think Hollywood is taking the tack that what patients are feeling. which is, this is broken. Like, you know, Tom on the show has gone through this with his dad. We've all been patients. It's very, very, very hard. But when you have that amazing experience, right, where everybody's firing on all cylinders and the nurses are collaborating with the doctors, collaborating with the RTs, collaborating with the dietitian and the housekeeper and everybody, and there's a compassion that wells up and a purpose in the center of it that comes through, then you know, okay, this is a thing.
And my challenge is, how do you create that?
How do you create that? So do you think the business stuff, the management training that you got helps you to do that, or do you think it's another hurdle in the way of just transcending that?
You know, I think it, one of the things we get no training in a medical school is, how do we hire people?
Right, no clue.
Yeah.
I hired these two assholes.
I know.
I regret it every single day. There's not a day that goes by, they're back there laughing.
You could do a New Amsterdam, just fire them both right
now. Okay. Guys, thanks for coming. Which one of you runs the show? All right.
You do work for me.
Actually, we work for each other, which makes it really weird.
Anyway, you know, how do you choose people? How do you identify who's going to do a good job and who's going to do less than a good job? And that's nothing that we're ever taught.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's things you have to learn a little bit and things you have to rely on your gut for.
Yeah. Well, tell me, teach us now, because you've been in this position now for a long time where you've been a clinical physician who now does leadership. You're in a really respected organization that I've spoken for Dignity before. I found their leadership to be fairly enlightened.
Right.
Their director of nursing, Paige, was fantastic. These are good people. And again, they're not sponsoring the show or anything. You're coming on your own. But tell us, what would you like this big audience of Z-Packers to kind of know? What are the issues that matter to you? What would you ask of them in terms of leadership and in terms of how they work with their leaders?
Right. So first of all, I think we need more clinicians in leadership. Mm. We need more clinicians who want to run hospitals, want to run medical groups, want to be division leaders. We need more people to step up. Mm. And what I think of is the thing that kind of keeps me going every day is I think of, what are the things that patients want from us? I think there's four things. Mm. When you go in and you're a patient, you want to be cured, number one. You want them to be kind to you. You want to be kept safe. And you don't want to be bankrupt. So those are the four things that all patients want.
Seems like basic needs.
Basic needs. So how do we address those needs?
Right.
How do we do a good job of keeping our patients safe, being kind to them, actually coming up with high quality, good outcomes, and in the end, not bankrupting them? Our country, as you know, we do a terrible job with having cost-effective healthcare.
Yeah.
And one of the things...
As Jason says, we're reactive, not proactive.
Right.
That's how we are.
Yeah.
So continue. Yeah.
So one of the big things I want to put out there is clinical transformation. You call it healthcare 3.0, I think. Well, there are a number of names for it. But what I mean is, as physicians, we can develop and help develop protocols that are not only have better outcomes, but are less costly and actually, you know, improve our likelihood to do well. A good example is when I was in medical school, we gave everyone blood. If your crit fell below 30, you got blood. Never give one unit, you give two units. And now, you know, we don't transfuse if you're down to near 21 or so, because we learned it's a bad thing. So guess what we accomplished? We lowered our costs, we improved our outcome, improved our length of stay, boom, 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 home run.
Yeah.
Doctors did that. We need more things like that.
That's a great example. By doing less, we've actually done more.
Right.
And have you noticed this, that better quality care almost inevitably comes at a lower cost?
I think those words should be inscribed somewhere, because that's a true epiphany that I learned, and I think it's really true.
Yeah, so people are always asking me, how are we gonna fix healthcare? When will Health 3.0 come?
Yeah.
You guys, it's not when, how, it must come. To lower the cost, we have to improve quality.
Right.
Otherwise, it's the opposite. We can raise costs and watch the quality decrease. That's what we've seen. It's an inverse correlation for a variety of reasons.
Because doctors like shiny objects.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Like robots.
That's why I have my Camry, because it's so shiny.
Yeah. Perfect.
Like robots. Tell me about it.
You know, robots. It's like, so robots, I mean, these things cost millions of dollars.
Yep.
There's one robot company, so it's a monopoly. So they name their price.
Da Vinci guys?
Da Vinci.
Yeah.
But prove to me that patients get better outcomes with robots. I know there are a couple things
prostate surgery,
but gallbladders, I'm not so sure. You know, appendectomies, oh, come on. Hernias, nah. So how do but the robot makers, they'll try to get you to do robotic tonsillectomies. Mm-hmm. Seriously.
That's
ridiculous. It's a 10-minute operation. You should be home in 1 hour, right?
Yeah.
So
I don't want the HAL 9000 working on my tonsils. So my prostate? Hell yeah.
But maybe Alexa could do your tonsils.
Alexa could do it. Alexa, remove tonsils. Removing tonsils now. Yeah, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
No, but you're right. But you're right. And actually, the Bleeding Edge documentary that we reviewed a while back was about FDA approval for devices, and Da Vinci was brought into it because they're really, again, apart from prostate and certain things, not useful. But of course, the surgeons might want to use it because it's cool, and then they can advertise.
And you can sit down and operate.
Yeah,
it's like driving a car.
So. I mean, Todd could operate.
Yeah, I could operate that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But so that dollar that I get for doing healthcare, 60 cents goes to labor, 35 cents goes to supply costs, the second biggest cost.
So, okay, 60 cents to labor, 35 is supply.
Supplies.
Now, where are all my material management people at? Tell me, give me a holla in the comments. That's a huge cost.
It is huge.
In a hospital.
And in a hospital. It's it's very, very expensive.
Right.
And it costs less in Europe. For some reason, they've got the cost, the supply cost thing down.
Why?
You know, I'm not really sure why. Yeah. For, you know, you tell me why pharma charges less for a hepatitis C drug in Europe than they do for us. I think it's because we're willing to pay it.
We're willing to pay it. And we don't have the negotiating clout. So Medicare cannot negotiate with drug companies.
But I love this new law that came out that says now the direct-to-consumer advertisements have to show what the price is.
Ah, that's interesting.
That's
right?
Going to kill it.
Yeah, so when you see like Enbrel, you know, for that little trace of rheumatoid you may or may not have, ask your doctor about Enbrel. And then Enbrel costs $40,000 a shot. You're like, ah! Okay, I'm out.
My favorite is restless leg syndrome. I'm pretty sure I'm not looking.
I've got
sure
it right got now, it right dude. Now. Yeah. I'm like shaking my leg constantly.
I could sell you drugs for all day long for
you
that.
You know what? And I'll buy them from you because you're an anesthesiologist, and I defer to authority. There's a power distance already.
Yeah.
I don't even want to question. And this is the other thing. I think there's a lot of superstition around questioning our doctors and even nurses questioning doctors. Doctors, you know, there's so much culture change that has to happen. But I think it has to start with us appreciating and understanding the business side of this. This is something that I don't emphasize. Like, I get in my Doc Vader suit and I rally the troops because he's pissed off. And we have a thing called the Doc Vader Index. The better Doc Vader is doing, the worse healthcare is right now because it means people are resonating with it. I'm hoping one day that DVI goes to zero because it means that we've solved some of these problems. Lower cost, better outcomes, more teamwork, support each other, no power distance, but still we're in a holarchy. Right. So you know much more about anesthesia than I will ever know. And I will respect and use that. But then again, I'll be able to tell you about hospital medicine and the nurse will be able to tell us how we're killing the patient at any given time. And that's a beautiful thing, but we need clinical leaders to do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're at 10:55, and I know you have to be at the airport at 11.
No, to leave at 11.
You have to leave at 11. So yeah, otherwise you're already done. Yeah. You're going to be here with me. You have this platform now. I'm giving you my platform because I think what you have to say is important. I think our group here, I get a lot of messages from administrators, and they are sad. They're sad meaning I sense so much anger, resentment, fear. And what we're trying to do is what you want, which is build a better healthcare system that's sustainable, where people are paid, but they also are supported. Work with us instead. What do you want to tell our tribe?
So I think that the real bogey that we have going forward is clinical transformation. It's the way we're going to get costs down, we're going to get outcomes better. So how do we do these things that you just described that are actually better for our patients and cost less? So, you know, we talked about blood transfusion, there's antimicrobial stewardship. There are a lot of things that we as physicians can come up with because we were trained to do this, which will improve patients' outcome at a lower cost. And MBAs and MHAs, we love you. However, the MDs need to be the ones leading this. We don't want other people telling us how we can be better because we spend a lot of time, a lot of money in school, and I think we kind of know what the right thing is. And so I need, you know, right now I was telling you earlier, I've got two of my four hospital presidents are physicians. I need to have more physicians in positions of leadership across the country. And let us redesign healthcare together with nurses. Nurses make great leaders. Yeah. Dietitians.
Yeah.
You know, anyone who's been in healthcare delivery knows what that dance is like and should be there making decisions that impact us.
Yeah.
I'm very passionate about this.
Yeah, no, that came through when I talked to you, and that's why I wanted you on the show, because people need to be inspired to do this. It's not selling out. It's not becoming a trader.
Right.
It's not because you're just straight burned out and you just don't want to see patients anymore.
Yeah.
Right? Although some people do do that.
Right.
It's more exactly what you're saying, that if we don't lead it, you know what? They're going to do it for us.
Right.
And when we were on the phone, you were pissed off about how all these regulation and the business side of it is pushing us to do the wrong thing, because they think about us as widgets and commodities, but we're not. There's something transcendent about what we do. We know what it is, but it also obeys certain business principles, like less is more, like we can create value and still have really good outcomes, that some processes should be standardized with room to violate them for that individual patient. But if we don't know the standard, how will we know when we're supposed to violate?
Yeah, we do not want to become commodities. A lot of our specialties, yours and mine in particular, have become commoditized.
Yep.
I mean, I can buy hospitalists on the spot market. I can just, you know, what are they going for? You know, $65 a head, I'll give you $50.
It's like pork belly futures.
Yeah.
Hospitals' bellies.
But what am I getting? What am I getting for that? And how do you feel as a commodity? You feel like a piece of crap.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the worst, the people that have been impacted by this, or the worst impact, has been radiologists. Radiology, and you know this because your wife was a radiologist, but right now in San Francisco, the payment for reading a chest x-ray is $7.50. That's what it's come to.
Mm.
I mean, these guys were, you know, they were in high clover at one point, and now it's like, I'll read this in 10 seconds. But it used to be, remember what it was with the radiologist? You'd meet him in the reading room and you'd consult with him. You'd say, you know, I got this patient. I mean, can you help me diagnose this? And it was a conversation.
It's a beautiful
thing.
Yeah.
And how do we, so how do we re-differentiate ourselves? How do we reinvent our specialty so we bring back that good mojo we had working one another, working with one another? You know, I'm not trying to make America great again, but I am saying there were some good things back then, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was our collegiality, and it was our conversation, our transparency. We got to bring that back so we don't feel like commodities.
So we're making medicine great again in a way that it was never great.
Exactly.
So in other words, it was great in certain ways, it was terrible in others. We're going to make it even better.
In the ways that it should be
in
better.
In the ways that it should be better. And who's going to do it? Us, clinicians, clinicians, leaders, with our business partners, we're going to do it.
Right.
Dr. Todd Strumwasser, Senior Vice President of Operations at Dignity Health San Francisco Hospitals. It has been a pleasure to have you on the show to give us the other side that we often miss in this conversation.
It's been a pleasure to be here, and maybe I can come back again.
Hell yeah. Actually, I may come up there and interview you at the hospital.
We'll do it.
You can give me a tour.
Sequoia.
Yeah. Oh, Sequoia's a great place.
It is a great place.
Yeah, yeah, I love it there.
Tom was born there, is that right?
Tom was born in Sequoia Hospital.
Yeah, we should rename it Tom Hospital.
The Tom Heineberg.
St. Tom's.
St. Tom's. St. Thomas. St. Thomas of Heineberg.
Yeah, wearing his stretchy outfit he's wearing.
You know what? He's a millennial. You cannot fault him for athleisure wear. I hate you so much, Tom Heineberg. I love you, Todd Strumwasser. And we out.
Okay.